Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the fallout on Wall Street from the new book Flash Boys by Michael Lewis and the recent 60 Minutes expose of high-speed trading that reached the conclusion that the stock market is rigged. William Cohan, the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, and a contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times, joins us to discuss Wall Street's rigged system that allows favored investors to pay hundreds of millions of dollars to locate their computers close to stock exchange data centers so they can trade milliseconds ahead of ordinary investors, thus front-running the market. Then we'll get an update from David Gleave, a chief investigator for aviation safety investigations and an expert with the Transport Research Group at Loughborough University in the UK. Weeks ago, when the Malaysian airliner first disappeared, he predicted it was deliberately flown into the remote southern Indian Ocean so that it will never be found. We will discuss the latest turn in the investigation that is focusing on a psychological profile of the pilot and co-pilot and whether the plane's black box can be found before it stops transmitting its location, which, based on the life of its battery, may be only a week away. Then finally, we'll examine the Ebola breakout in Guinea, which an official with Médecins Sans Frontières says is unprecedented. We will get an understanding of how bad it is and whether it will get worse from Dr. Stuart Nicol, chief of the Viral Special Pathogens Branch at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia. He is currently leading the U.S. response to the Ebola breakout in Guinea that has now spread to neighboring Liberia. And joining us now is William Cohan, the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. William Cohan is a contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times, where he covers a variety of financial issues. His book, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, details the last days of Bear Stearns. He also wrote The Last Tycoon, The Secret History of Lazard, Frère and Company. And his new book coming out soon is The Price of Silence, which is about the 2006-2007 Duke LaCrosse scandal. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Cohan.
Thank you, Ian. Great to be here.
And 60 Minutes, a piece on Sunday with Michael Lewis, plugging his new book, Flash Boys, really made some pretty strong statements. When you say that the stock market is rigged, them are fighting words, as they say in the Westerns, you know?
Yeah.
So you're there on Wall Street. You cover Wall Street. How's Wall Street responding?
Well, I worked on Wall Street for 17 years. I was never a broker, but I certainly carefully followed as an M&A, mergers and acquisitions banker, carefully followed the markets. To say they're rigged is, of course, very powerful words, as you said, and certainly gets people's attention. So if you wanted to, promote your book on 60 Minutes, there's probably no better way than to say that the market is rigged. So Michael Lewis is a genius in that regard. The issue of whether high-speed traders have figured out ways to get an advantage over other people in the market is something that, we've known about close to a decade now. Even in June 2011, 60 Minutes did a piece on high-frequency traders, mentioned the words market rigged any number of times. So it's not a subject that's even new to 60 Minutes. I think that, the genius of Michael Lewis is that his ability to sort of find somebody that basically nobody had ever heard of who felt aggrieved by this, i.e. the executive at Royal Bank of Canada that he identified, who then started his own exchange that is now the subject of Michael Lewis's book, and figured out that something didn't feel right, that he would try to make trades and the people would jump in front of him, and then he tried to figure out a way to circumvent that. And when he successfully did that, he marketed that to all sorts of clients and then decided to go out on his own. But I think in truth the stock market has probably been I don't know whether rigged is the right word, but certainly a market that advantages the big traders, and it's been that way for a very, very long time, and it's always been a rough place for small traders, as we all have found out on numerous occasions over the last 100 years. And so, you know, again, the genius of Michael Lewis is to take something that everybody kind of knows about already and craft a nice little story in a soundbite and get a lot of attention, which he certainly has done.
And the trader that you're talking about, Brad Katsuyama, he's built an alternative electronic exchange called IEX. But the 60 Minutes piece and the book by Michael Lewis basically suggest that the people who are to blame are the hedge funds and investment banks engaged in high-frequency trading. And my understanding is that it's the real villains here are the big stock exchanges, which are enabling and at the same time profiting from the extra fast trading access that they provide to certain investors. And specifically, we're talking here about the New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, and BATS, B-A-T-S, which apparently is the they're the people who pioneered this electronic exchanges. So that's what's going on, right? You give your favored entities, whoever they might be, access as close as possible to the New York Exchange so that there's a millisecond advantage because the pipeline doesn't have to go very far, the electronic pipeline. Is that the situation?
Well, that's the theory, right? I think, you know, one of the, again, I've not yet had a chance to read Michael's book, but just, you know, in the 60 Minutes piece and then the pieces in New York Times Magazine and then I think Andrew Ross Sorkin's column in the New York Times today sort of made the point that you made, that the exchanges are getting the advantage. I mean, the thing that I found, you know, disturbing and not new, but disturbing, continuously disturbing, is the fact that some of these exchanges are front-running their clients. So taking the information that's coming into the exchange about the trade that a hedge fund wants to make or an investment bank wants to make, and the people behind these high-frequency trading operations are seeing that information and trading on it a millisecond before the actual order can get executed, which is why the fellow at Royal Bank of Canada couldn't get his trades executed, which is why he decided on this sort of slowdown method, which was, you know, sort of the light bulb moment for him. But again, you know, unfortunately, and it's not pretty, but people, even under the old ticker tape method, traders on the New York Stock Exchange would read the tape and trade on that information before their clients. And so this is something that has gone on for a very long time. I think, you know, Michael Lewis has made it sexier by focusing on high-speed trading and milliseconds and exchanges and, you know, showing route maps of fiber optic cable between lower Manhattan and the exurbs of New Jersey. But, you know, people, like in my book about Goldman Sachs, I talk about how Goldman has often been criticized for trading ahead of its clients and taking its clients' information and using every piece of it to Goldman's advantage. And even I interviewed any number of clients in that book who were aware that Goldman was doing it, but decided that, you know, all things being equal, they'd still rather have Goldman's expertise in executing whatever assignment they wanted them to execute rather than go to somebody who may not be doing that because of the expertise that Goldman brings. I mean, the markets have always been an uneven playing field. If you don't think big clients get an advantage over small clients, big clients who are doing hundreds of millions of dollars of fee-generating business every year with Wall Street and the exchanges don't get preferential treatment and haven't gotten preferential treatment for a very long time over small clients and customers, then, you know, I've got a bridge in Brooklyn that I'd like to sell you real cheap, because this has been going on for hundreds of years.
Now, in terms of your book, Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, William Cohan, the 60 Minutes piece actually suggested that Goldman Sachs, who apparently were one of the first in on this high-frequency trading racket, shall we call it, they apparently are in favor of these new rules that this trader who set up this new exchange wants to implement. But at the same time, Goldman Sachs is underwriting an initial public offering for Virtue Financial, which specializes in high-frequency trading. So there you have speaking with a forked tongue, to use another analogy out of the Westerns.
Well, that is the Goldman Sachs business plan, business model to a T. I mean, you've got to give them credit. Obviously, they knew the content, by and large, of what was going to be in Michael's book. He had done a piece for Vanity Fair, of course, where I also write, about a technician at Goldman Sachs who was claimed to, Goldman claimed, stole some code from Goldman, and of course he claimed that it was open source code. And so, I mean, Goldman knew that Michael Lewis's book was going to stir up a hornet's nest, so intelligently, I think, they had Gary Cohn, the president of Goldman Sachs, write an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal late last week, basically coming out in support of the new exchange that was created and sort of, you know, fair trading, which, of course, you know, definitely benefits Goldman Sachs. It definitely benefits their clients because, you know, Goldman stands to benefit through, you know, fair, you know, more, you know, openness and people feeling more confident in the market. I mean, frankly, it's hard for people to feel less confident in the market than, you know, than people do now, especially when, you know, they realize that there are people who are getting advantages. So them coming out for something that seems fairer than and that could, in fact, be fair, of course, inures to their benefit. At the same time, of course, you know, if there's a successful high-frequency trader who hasn't lost money in whatever it is, a year's worth of trading days, because they're out in front of everybody and seeing orders before they can get filed, and that company's making a lot of money, well, Goldman was more than happy to take a fee in underwriting that deal and selling it to investors, you know, all over the world. That is, in fact, their business plan. Both things can be true. That's the, you know, kind of the genius, if you will, or the villainy, if that's your preference, of Goldman Sachs. I mean, and much of Wall Street. They're more than willing to take fees whenever an opportunity presents itself. And if there's a PR situation they can get out in front of, they're more than happy to a PR situation that they can get out in front of. They're more than happy to, you know, try to be smart about it and do that. And this is a case where Goldman, for a change, actually was smart in its public relations strategy by getting out ahead of this.
So this business of getting out ahead, of course, is what we're talking about in terms of these high-speed trading. And you mentioned front-running, which is what in fact is happening here, where you buy stocks before somebody is about to buy them and then sell them back to them at a profit. Front-running is illegal. But somehow or other, we're not sure whether high-speed trading is illegal. The FBI apparently have opened up a probe into whether these high-speed trading firms are engaged in insider trading. And one of the things that they're looking into is that there's a method of trading where a firm makes a big order for trades in a company's stock but then cancels them, giving the illusion that the stock is, you know, hot and active. That's just one of them. They're also looking into whether these firms that are trading stocks were granted early information ahead of institutional investors. That on the surface, is obviously illegal. So walk us through why it is that front-running is illegal, but electronic front-running is not.
Well, I mean, people talk about front-running being illegal, and I'm sure that, in fact, I'm not a lawyer, that there might even be laws against it, but I've never heard of a case actually brought. You know, people anecdotally have told me for years that Goldman, as I say, you know, sort of front runs their clients, or has in the past front run their clients, take their clients' information and trade it on it. I, as I say, I cite numerous examples of that in my book, but you know, how does one ever really prove that? How does, I mean, I haven't seen any prosecution of that kind of a charge. you know, Michael Lewis said that this high frequency trading isn't illegal. You know, it wasn't illegal for Goldman Sachs to bet against the mortgage market at the same time that it was underwriting and selling mortgage-backed securities in 2006 and 2007. I mean, there are many things that seem to us to be wrong, but that aren't illegal. You know, and that's a function of the way the laws are written and the way that Wall Street helps to write the laws and knows the specifics of the law down to, you know, a dotted I and the cross T much better than anybody, you know, obviously a layperson would. So my sense is that, you know, it's going to be very, very hard. There'll be a plenty for the FBI to investigate, but I suspect it'll be very, very hard to bring a successful prosecution of this. You know, again, this high-frequency trading has been going on for, you know, 10, 20 years, you know, a long time. Obviously, it's far more sophisticated now than it had been because, you know, you're talking about people co-locating their trading operations, you know, as close as they possibly can to the switches and the data centers over in New Jersey and to try to get that millisecond advantage. The only reason they're doing that, of course, is to try to make money. And you know, again, I haven't seen any laws that say that that's illegal. It doesn't sound right. And I think, again, the beauty of what Michael Lewis has done is, even though we've sort of known about this, he has an ability to raise this to a new level in people's minds and bring it to a wider audience. And, of course, when people hear on 60 Minutes that he says the market is rigged, well, that gets people's attention. And then, of course, his story is so, you know, captivating and well-written and entertaining that, you know, it makes it probably will lead to change. And it might even lead to some of these high-frequency traders being put out of business. And, you know, Goldman Sachs is smart enough to, you know, see where this might be heading and trying to get on the right side of it.
Well, apparently already, William Cohen, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission and the Securities Exchange Commission are both looking into whether these exchanges are giving preferential treatment to these high-speed trading firms, which, of course, seems to be the case. You do have to ask yourself, where was the Securities and Exchange Commission and the CFTC all of these years that you just mentioned? Why weren't they doing it? I mean, let's face it, in 2012, a New Jersey firm, Knight Capital, lost $440 million in a glitch, a computer glitch, executing 150 mistaken orders on the New York Stock Exchange. And then in 2010, in May of 2010, the computerized trading apparently was the reason why there was the flash crash, which briefly sent U.S. markets tumbling by about 5% before the glitch was discovered. So there's another issue there, isn't there? How, you know, not only are people taking advantage of computer trading, but also the computer trading itself is not without its problems.
Well, that is for sure. Of course, we don't know why that flash crash, you know, the layman anyway, doesn't really understand why that flash crash occurred. I mean, the fact that regulators are behind the eight ball on this topic and on many topics is something that I've wondered about, you know, for years. I mean, why were all the regulators nowhere to be found until after the market crashed in 2008? Where were they before that when you know, the markets were heating up in mortgage-backed securities? Where was the Fed? Why didn't the Fed take the punch bowl away as they're supposed to do? I mean, you know, this is a pattern that has been repeating for years. I mean, the last time I can think of that the SEC was really focused on cracking down on wrongdoing on Wall Street was probably back, you know, in the 80s and they weren't even so great at it then, but at least they were better when it was clear that they were beginning. John Shadd, the head of the SEC, was leading a charge against insider trading, basically. But since then, it's been, you know, a pushover agency. The CFTC has had its moments of clairvoyance, for instance, when it went after the LIBOR scandal. But basically, it has been a pushover agency. The Justice Department clearly has not brought any criminal cases against anybody for what happened during the financial crisis. So, I mean, the fact that they're all looking at it, they look at things when the media starts making a big stink. And, of course, you know, in the heels of the 60 Minutes show on Sunday night, you know, now this is the subject where everybody is focused and they're going to, quote unquote, do their investigations. But the proof is in the pudding, Ian. I mean, how many times do these guys say they're going to look at things and then nothing ever comes of it? So I'm not going to hold my breath thinking that, you know, we're going to see a slew of people prosecuted for, quote unquote, illegal high frequency trading by co-locating their trading operations as close to the data centers as in New Jersey as they possibly can. I just don't, you know, I'm sure that is, they're going to not be able to find a case worth prosecuting there.
Well, William Cohen, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
And likewise. Again, I've been speaking with William Cohen, the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. He's a contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times, where he covers a variety of financial issues. His book, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, details the last days of Bear Stearns and Company. He also wrote The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Laissez Faire and Company. And his latest book out soon is The Price of Silence, which is about the 2006 and 2007 Duke Lacrosse scandal. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with David Gleave, who first predicted weeks ago when the Malaysian airline first disappeared that it was deliberately flown into the remote southern Indian Ocean.
The peddlers and the meddlers, they buy and they sell. They destroyed your city, they'll destroy you as well. The lecherous and treacherous, a hair mental weather. Each of them bigger than all men put together. Sluggers and muggers wearing fancy gold.
Kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I believe in.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from the UK is David Gleave, who is a chief investigator for aviation safety investigations and an expert with the Transportation Research Group at Loughborough University. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Gleave.
Hello. It's good to be back.
And we spoke a few weeks ago early in the this agony over the disappearance of Malaysian Flight 370. And you were, I think, the first person to bring up the idea that the plane probably went into the southern Indian Ocean because it could disappear there and never be found, and that there was a real likelihood that this was pilot or crew suicide. That seems to be where the investigation is now heading, with psychological profiles and analysis of the last recordings from the cockpits, which, by the way, the Malaysian authorities gave the wrong information from the get-go. Apparently, the communication from the cockpit was not, as was earlier reported, all right, good night. The last transmission was, good night, Malaysian 370. So let's start with that. What explains that discrepancy?
I think that it's obviously been a very quick listening to something, possibly a little bit of lost in translation by the time it's been written down and passed on. It does take a while for the transcripts to come through from the air traffic controllers, investigators who would transcribe these tapes. Normally it would take 1 to 2 days for the transcripts to come out because they need to be time coordinated with everything else. Some of the time the recorders run at a different time from the radar recordings, from the flight deck recordings and other things like that. So you need to coordinate the time bases, but you hopefully use GPS time these days to timestamp everything to make that a lot easier. I think to some extent we're just getting some early information, and the general message was everything seemed to be fine when the aeroplane left Malaysian airspace. And I think there could be some level of dumbing down of the message as well, just to say, everything's okay, good night, which is effectively what the message means, that they're quite happy to transfer frequency over to Ho Chi Minh City.
Well, it's just odd, though, that after all of the speculation that has been going on, it's only this, a couple of days ago on Monday, that the Malaysian Transport Ministry gave out the accurate transcript of the final message.
Yes, but I think that, I mean, I've read through the transcript. There's a couple of what I would regard as poor air traffic control techniques when the airplane's on the ground. But apart from that, there's nothing which is remarkable whatsoever about it. So it's almost not important in that part of the investigation, that everything appears to be fine. What is missing, if you were trying to link this through to anything, is we have a reasonable idea where the aeroplane was when that last transmission was made, probably within 1 to 2 miles in terms of its location from the radar. But after that, what we don't know is when the pilot may have been able to contact Ho Chi Minh City, principally because we don't have anything in the public domain at the moment saying what the radio coverage was from Vietnam. It could be that the aeroplane was entering a dark hole of 10 minutes before it came out into being able to contact the next air traffic control center. Or it could have been that just by pushing one button to transfer the frequency on the flight deck, you would then be able to open your transmitter and talk. So that would be the interesting part of the investigation. I don't think there's anything sinister in the air traffic control tape itself, other than to say that's the last communication, it was entirely routine, and perhaps we'd like to know that which of the two pilots on board the aeroplane actually made that transmission. That's quite a key fact.
So, David Glebe, then, in our last conversation, which again was at the very beginning of this investigation into this mysterious tragedy, you talked about that the plane probably went into the southern Indian Ocean, not the northern route as the alternative scenario was, because that would be a way that it would never be found. And that seems to be where we're heading. We've only got 5 days left on the black box transmitter, and all they seem to be turning up with these massive searches by both ship and air are floating debris from fishing boats, and you know, it looks like the entire oceans of the world are a huge garbage dump. So what's your sense then of whether or not this plane is ever going to be found?
Well, I think we have to sort of keep a reasonably open mind about it. Yes, it's believed to have gone into the southern Indian Ocean, and if my theory or one of the suggested theories is correct, that it's gone there not to be found, we have to continue to look by satellite and by air search, if possible, to see if there is anything that's floating. I think if somebody crashed the aeroplane deliberately into the sea, with a degree of planning, they'd do it in a manner to minimize the amount of debris that actually floated, to make it as difficult to find as possible. But also, we have to be a little bit careful with how we regard the black box pingers. Firstly, if they have been able to disable them, then obviously they won't be transmitting, so we won't be able to find anything from that. But secondly, the black boxes have to transmit for at least 30 days. That's a minimum in the worst possible sea temperature and conditions that they would encounter. So I'm reasonably hopeful that the black box pinger units will continue to transmit for more than 30 days, but certainly the race is on. At the moment, if you look at the statistics, there's something like 100,000 square miles that it could be located in. They need to get that down to about 1,000 to actually use the toadfish that's now gone out there. We don't know if there's any submarines out listening for it, and we won't be told either. But there may well be naval assets that are trying to listen for the pinger unit as well. And obviously we need to narrow the search area down using any means that is available to us, be it further analysis of flight path data and radar data, further analysis of wind and meteorological data for the aeroplane's flight path. I think we're pretty much now at the limit of what we can extract from the Inmarsat satellite data. So it's then a question of just keep looking. And unfortunately, we may in about 2 to 3 weeks' time, say the pinger units should have stopped transmitting by now, and then we will be down to some really very difficult search conditions because we'll have to start mapping the bottom of the ocean to see what we can see. And it's not as if we can do a comparative map either, because most of this area of the ocean is pretty much unmapped, at least the ocean floor. We know it's very, very deep, so ships aren't going to bang into anything. But it is not well mapped, certainly to the resolution we'd need to be able to find the aeroplane.
Again, I'm speaking with David Glebe, who is a chief investigator for aviation safety investigations and an expert with the Transport Research Group at Loughborough University in the United Kingdom. And again, when we last spoke weeks ago, when this tragedy and mystery began, David, you did bring up the speculation that this could have been suicide for perhaps insurance purposes, and that's why the plane was deliberately lost in the middle of nowhere. There have, of course, been other incidents in the past. There was the crash of Egypt Air 9, Flight 990 in 1990, I think it was 96 or 99, and then the Silk Air Flight 185 in 1997. And there was another one in Africa, wasn't there?
Yes, relatively recently, about 3 months ago. I think the aeroplane was flying from Mozambique to Angola and crashed into the thin strip which hangs out to the east of Namibia. That was an Embraer jet where the current theory is that the captain took control of the aeroplane, locked the first officer out, and he went to the toilet and then subsequently crashed the aeroplane from there. That's the current thinking. Although the report has yet to be issued, then certainly statements have been made saying that is what they believe has happened.
But what was, is there anything
to, unknown.
Is there anything to be learned, though, from the Egypt Air flight out of JFK that crashed shortly after takeoff, and the Silk Air, any sense? I mean, obviously the Egyptian authorities didn't agree that this was pilot suicide, although U.S. and other investigators believe that was the case. Has there ever been any understanding of motivation? Obviously that's what most people listening will be saying, you know, why would somebody do this and take all those other lives with them? I mean, it is truly a profound mystery and very upsetting one at that.
Yes, indeed. And I think we have to look culturally. We need to set aside our own individual particular judgments and start to think as the culture of the nationality and the culture of the individual would start to reflect on that. And certainly it can be very difficult for a country which is reasonably Christian-based in its attitudes and thinking and its open-mindedness and communication to understand how some of the other cultures in the world work. I think if you studied the background of the pilot that is alleged to have committed suicide using the Silk Air aeroplane, then there were some relatively understandable factors coming in terms of his financial situation. But also we need to understand what they call a loss of face. He was in danger of being demoted by the airline from captain to first officer with a subsequent reduction in salary, but also status is exceedingly important, and that may have acted as the trigger at that point in time. So we have to be a little bit careful to look at these things through Western eyes, that it doesn't always make sense to us, but that's why we need the specialist psychologists to come in and look at potential triggers, but also understand how much each trigger is valued in each particular culture or religious background, rather than just looking at things as we perceive them in North America or sort of Northern Europe.
Well, David Glebe, apparently the Malaysian authorities are looking into these last transmissions and trying to figure out who made the last communications from the cockpit. And they are doing what exactly you suggested, trying to do psychological profiling. Apparently they've also done extensive investigations into the flight simulator that the captain, Zahari Ahmad Shah, had in his home. And there's also some speculation that since that Captain Shah apparently has been upset after a recent divorce or at least breaking up with his wife. Do you have any more information on whether those possible motives are in play?
Well, I haven't undertaken this particular psychological investigation. I have acted as a reviewing psychologist on other cases like this. All I can say is that if we look at the loss of face associated with your wife walking out in a typical Muslim culture, then that can act as a psychological trigger. It's one possible explanation of what went on. I think there needs to be a lot more firming up of facts and psychological backgrounds before we can make any definitive statement. But it would be very useful if we were able to recover the aeroplane, not necessarily because of the cockpit voice recorder would tell us very much, because I would expect that to be overwritten, as it only lasts about 2.25 hours before the chips are effectively recycled and the messages recorded over. But just to find out who was actually on the flight deck at the time of the accident, should it have been crashed into the Indian Ocean, that would give us a very strong clue as to the person that may have been responsible, if that indeed is the case.
So is there any way that we can speculate the extent to which the passengers knew about anything that was happening here? Because it's in the middle of the night, they don't necessarily know what direction they're going in, and perhaps they don't even know that the plane made this turn. What's the latest thinking on that? Were they incapacitated or were they conscious?
Well, again, trying to get the raw data facts out of the radar tapes, I've not been privileged to be able to undertake the radar data analysis, but effectively it would be quite possible to turn the aeroplane at night without the passengers realizing it. You feel very slightly heavier in a turn than you would do otherwise. There's no real horizon there with lights on the ground for you to make any reference to. And by disabling things like the in-flight entertainment system, you would take out the moving map, so you wouldn't be able to tell from that you were necessarily much of a turn either. So it's possible to turn the aeroplane without passengers realizing which direction you're going in. And by depressurizing the aeroplane, it would be possible after quite a long period of time for the passengers to become hypoxic, drowsy, and then eventually die of hypoxia through a lack of oxygen. And you could achieve that at the cruising altitude of the aeroplane or by climbing higher and manipulating some of the valves on the aircraft, which are normally used for pressurizing the aeroplane. But that's effectively, if the aeroplane was depressurized deliberately, then the oxygen masks would descend in the cabin, as you see in your pre-flight briefings. But that oxygen only lasts something like half an hour to 45 minutes. And after that, then you would become hypoxic and effectively pass out.
So just in closing then, David Gleave, you mentioned the possibility that some of these naval assets, particularly these nuclear submarines, that the U.S. has quite a few of them. And, you know, with the end of the Cold War, there's actually been a surplus of nuclear submarines. The Australians have diesel submarines, and I think India may have one nuclear submarine. But it's conceivable, I take it, that there could be a lot of these naval assets under the water there. I imagine they'd be pretty effective, wouldn't they, since they have such finely tuned sonar?
Yes, I mean, they're capable of listening to emissions on just about any frequency, particularly the intelligence-gathering submarines rather than the sort of ballistic missile submarines themselves. So and again, I would say that a diesel submarine would be perfectly good. It's just that it takes some support that far from base. So yes, the Australians may be able to run diesel submarines around there with oiler ships running for them out of Perth and things like that. But they are limited by what they can do and then their engine power and the need to recharge their batteries and things. That would be perfectly good to be able to use those as well. But obviously nuclear submarines can just submerge for a very long period of time before they have to come back up again or need to take on any further provisions. So a nuclear submarine would be preferable principally because of its ability to generate quite high transit speeds to get to the various sites that it may be tasked with. It would be very useful to have them on board, but I very much doubt whether they would be declared into the public domain that they were taking part in the search. And then you have the problem that if you're asking for these types of submarines from different countries, some of which may cooperate with one another, some of which may not really want their intelligence-gathering submarines going up against intelligence-gathering submarines from other countries. So there needs to be a bit of a balance reached there as to who's carrying out these activities. But it would be most useful to have this type of submarine listening, because it would be able to clear reasonably large amounts of the ocean relatively quickly. Even so, it would still take quite a long period of time, and I have to caution that the French Navy declared that they had a nuclear submarine in the area of Air France 447 a few years ago that crashed off Brazil, and they didn't hear anything. But again, we wouldn't necessarily know quite what the submarine was equipped with or how it carried out its search at that point, because it's not information in the public domain.
Well, David Gleaver, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David Gleave, who is in the UK. He's a chief investigator for aviation safety investigations and an expert with the Transport Research Group at Loughborough University. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about the Ebola outbreak in Guinea that has also spread to neighbouring Liberia. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Stuart Nicol, who is the chief of the Viral Special Pathogens Branch at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, as well as a professor of microbiology and immunology at Emory University. He's currently leading the U.S. response to the Ebola outbreak in Guinea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Stuart Nicol.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be on the program.
And the Médecins Sans Frontières, the medical group, are saying that this outbreak in Guinea is unprecedented. How would you describe it?
I think it's I'm not sure I'd use such strong words, but it is an unusual outbreak for sure. This is the first time that we've seen Ebola virus in West Africa. So this is outside of the normal range where we've seen the past Ebola outbreaks. So in that sense, it's unprecedented. But many of the other characteristics of the outbreak at this point look quite similar to the past outbreaks.
But in terms of these sort of doomsday scenarios that we see in Hollywood movies, my understanding is that Ebola's never really gone beyond the various African countries where the outbreaks have happened. Whereas Marburg, that, of course, is named after a town in Germany, that did get to Europe. And I don't know remember where Marburg came from. But
yeah, I mean, that original Marburg outbreak of hemorrhagic disease in Germany and Yugoslavia really tracked back to the importation of African green monkeys, which had come in from Uganda. So that tracked back to, you know, the area where we know Marburg continues to circulate in bats in that part of Africa.
So then, are these diseases just endemic to Africa, or are they? I mean, I guess Marburg did spread, but I mean, what my sense is, what is this idea of it being unprecedented, and why does the world react as though we're about to have some kind of huge global contagion?
Yeah, I think that's a kind of gross over-exaggeration of the threat, I think, posed by these viruses. If we kind of cover Marburg virus first, I mean, as you say, that one has got outside of Africa a couple of times, in that the original discovery of the virus was that hemorrhagic disease outbreak in Germany and Yugoslavia back in 69. And more recently, actually, we have had importation of the virus into Europe, into a Dutch ecotourist who had been in a cave in Uganda and acquired the Marburg virus infection, went back to the Netherlands and came down and actually ended up being a fatal case of Marburg hemorrhagic fever. And another tourist actually independently who had gone to that same cave, this is a cave called Python Cave in Queen Elizabeth National Park in Uganda, and had gone back to Colorado. And on reading the reports of the Dutch tourist, figured out that maybe she had had Marburg also, and when we tested samples here at the CDC, indeed confirmed she had. So, Marburg has made it out side of Africa on a few occasions, but in general, these viruses are not very transmissible. And so the chances of the virus, getting into the capital, the chances of somebody infected getting on an airplane and going elsewhere in the world are pretty low. And then with kind of modern barrier nursing techniques, just the normal kind of procedures that have been put in place since the days of HIV, wearing gloves and gowns when you're interacting with patients and their body fluids, those are sufficient to prevent the transmission of these viruses. And so far, Ebola has never made it outside of Africa. And while it's a major concern in these rural, resource-poor areas of Africa, where you can see significant chains of transmission, person-to-person transmission, I mean, those are under conditions where you have, very poor hygiene conditions. Usually there's no soap, there's no water, there's no kind of, basic hygiene in place in these rural, resource-poor areas. And that's why you see these good chains of transmission going on. But in a more resource-rich area of the world, these viruses are not going to transmit efficiently at all. Does that kind of give you a sense?
It does, yes. And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Stuart Nicol, who's chief of the Viral Special Pathogens Branch at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, as well as a professor of microbiology and immunology at Emory University. He's currently leading the U.S. response to the Ebola outbreak in Guinea. So having just settled the idea that this is not a global outbreak, and presumably since you're heading up the U.S. response to this Ebola outbreak in Guinea, I take it you're not focusing in terms of the idea of the infection reaching the United States. And I don't want, and I'm sure you don't want to come across as not being concerned that Africans are dying and that being happy that Europeans are not dying. That is not the issue here. But so what exactly are you doing in terms of the U.S. response?
Yeah, so we are joining the international response and the national response in Guinea, and also providing technical assistance and advice to the surrounding countries, particularly Sierra Leone and Liberia. So actually, over the weekend, we just sent a 5-person team to Guinea who just arrived today. And they will be integrating with the rest of the response effort in Guinea, and will really be trying to improve the data management for the outbreak and understanding the epidemiology of the outbreak, and also helping with the health communications and getting out the messages to the population as to how to reduce their risk of acquiring this infection. So some of the important things that we do in these outbreaks are, the critical thing is to identify the infected people in the communities, get them out of the community and into isolation wards where they can be cared for and where we have in place good barrier nursing so we can protect the medical staff from acquiring the infection from these patients. And then we figure out who these infected individuals have had contact with in the community. So we do the contact tracing. We identify those people, and then we follow those for 21 days. And if any one of them starts a fever, then we'll bring them in for testing, find out whether they've got the virus or not, and if they have, then get them into the isolation ward. If they haven't, you know, there's lots of other infectious diseases circulating in these communities. You know, they can go home back into the community. And in this way, you know, we can identify these chains of transmission and we can stop them dead in the community. And once you do that, then basically you've got the outbreak under control.
But at this point, Dr. Stuart Nicol, my understanding is that the outbreak in Guinea has already spread to the capital, Conakry, which has a population of 2 million people. And the Senegalese singer, Youssef N'Dour, has canceled a concert because of this outbreak there in the nation's capital. It's also spread into neighboring Liberia. So it sounds like it's well gone beyond the very area where it first appeared.
I mean, certainly these things are of concern and need to be followed up on aggressively. But in terms of the spread, you know, the cases that we've seen in Conakry, in the capital in Guinea, and also the cases over the border in Liberia, all of these individuals had travel history to the affected area. So at this point, we have no evidence to suggest that there's ongoing chains of transmission, for instance, in Liberia. The confirmed cases so far all had travel to the southeast Guinea area where we know the virus was circulating. So certainly we need to keep our guard up. We need to very aggressively get on top of these cases and their contacts and aggressively follow them up and manage them to get the outbreak under control. But, you know, While I think there's certainly a need for caution and very aggressive follow-up, I don't think there's need for hysteria at this point. I mean, things are not out of control. I think now that the international response players are all getting on site and working very carefully and integrated with the National Ministry of Health folks, I think we're going to quickly get on top of the outbreak and bring it under control.
The Ebola, of course, it spreads by close contact and kills between 25 and 90% of its victims. In terms of any kind of treatment or preventive or any antibiotics, etc., I mean, is it because it's so rare that this isn't, or that it can't be treated, or the limited treatments? Or is it simply just too virulent to treat?
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head with the first statement. I mean, the problem is that there isn't a large market for a vaccine for Ebola or for Marburg. And, you know, it really affects these resource-poor rural communities in Africa. I mean, these aren't people who can really afford to buy an expensive vaccine or expensive antivirals. So given the lack of a real commercial market for these things, then there's fairly limited efforts in terms of development of good products that could help fight these outbreaks. The European and U.S. governments, you know, are investing some money in the development of these kinds of products, but you can come up with some promising drugs or some promising prototype vaccines, but to really take these products to the next step, to a real, you know, product in a bottle that a clinician could use, that would take a very large amount of money and really commercial companies to get heavily involved in it. And that's really unlikely to happen unless, you know, things change dramatically.
So how do health workers and those that take care of the sick, how do they prevent themselves from getting this disease if they're...
So it's actually relatively easy. I think you already mentioned that, you know, the way this virus is transmitted is by direct contact with a sick person. So it's only when people begin to display symptoms that they're infectious, and you really need direct contact with the people or with their body fluids to acquire the infection. So the medical staff can protect themselves fairly easily, you know, wearing gowns and double gloves, making sure that they protect their facial area either with goggles or a visor, and in this way quite easily protect themselves. So it's not like you see in some of the movies or, you know, in the magazines and what have you, where there's people in spacesuits out there in the jungle, you know, treating these people. It's kind of fairly basic, rudimentary barrier nursing protective equipment.
So, and how, in terms of early detection, I take it the symptoms are fever, weakness, muscle pain, headache, sore throat, mm-hmm. and then that deteriorates into vomiting, diarrhea, and then it could even...
Often hemorrhage.
And then hemorrhaging, point, yeah. Right. So...
Yeah. That's one of the challenges, is that the early symptoms for Ebola are kind of an acute febrile illness, you know, acute illness onset with fever. So it's very difficult from the initial clinical symptoms to tell the Ebola or Marburg cases, you know, from a lot of other tropical diseases which are circulating in these areas. So that's why it's important that we get diagnostic capability in place in country. And one of the things that's been done as part of this response is the European Consortium has put a mobile Ebola diagnostic lab into the southeast Guinea, actually into Gekedu, which is a town in the central area where this outbreak's occurring, so that they can basically do real-time diagnostics to support the isolation wards in the communities in the area. So they can very quickly tell whether a person who's turning up sick is really Ebola hemorrhagic fever or perhaps just malaria or one of many other infectious diseases that are circulating. It's very important because you really don't want to put into these isolation wards people that don't have Ebola, and then you put them at risk of having contact with other Ebola patients within the ward. So it's an important diagnostic test to run to find out, to get the people out of the communities and get them into these isolation wards, but make sure that we're only putting in, you know, the people that really deserve to be there.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Stuart Nicol, what then do you think that Médecins Sans Frontières is saying when they say it's unprecedented? In what way is it unprecedented, this outbreak of Ebola in Guinea?
I think they're... trying to stress that, you know, this is a new area. I mean, this is the first time we've seen Ebola in West Africa, so that's certainly of concern. And certainly it's an area where the national authorities it's not been on their radar in terms of how they would respond to this kind of outbreak in the past. And the numbers are fairly high. I mean, we're looking at over 100, 120 suspected or confirmed cases at this point. So it's a reasonable sized outbreak. But, you know, we have seen outbreaks as large as 400 and odd cases in the past. So this is not the largest outbreak for Ebola or Marburg hemorrhagic fever that we've seen. We hope with the response now in place that we can quickly cut off these ongoing chains of transmission and prevent these numbers from climbing very much higher. But it's probably going to take several more weeks to get the outbreak fully under control.
Well, Dr. Stuart Nicol, thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're more than welcome. Good to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Stuart Nicol, who's the chief of this viral special pathogens branch at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, as well as a professor of microbiology and immunology at Emory University. He is currently leading the U.S. response to the Ebola outbreak in Guinea. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.